brought to you by Burr and Foreman, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia. It's time for Results Matter Radio, where we bring you pertinent business information and offer real-life solutions to help drive desired results for you, whatever your business may be. Now, here are your hosts, Elizabeth Gordon and Lee Cantor.
Good morning. I'm Elizabeth Gordon, and Dana Barrett is with me as well to produce today's show. And we have a great show in store for you. So thank you for tuning in today to Results Matter Radio. Jim McCartan's with me, Burr and Foreman. Jim's been on the show a great many times. And today's panel is an interesting, interesting show. We're focusing on autism today, an autism roundtable, if you will. David Glass is here with us from Glass Financial Group, and Donna Johnson, Georgia Autism Plan Coordinator and Len Fellow for the Center for Leadership in Disability Institute of Public Health at Georgia State University. And J.J. Hurley is also here in the studio this morning, Autism Response Team Coordinator for the Southeast Region of Autism Speaks. So, Donna, let's start with you. Georgia State has some excellent resources that I don't think a lot of people are aware of. Could you give us a bit of background around your role and what you're working on?
Sure. I started at Georgia State as a Len Fellow, which is a fellowship in leadership and education in neurodevelopmental disabilities. I am the mother of a child with autism. Actually, I have three children. One of my twins has autism. And as a result of this training, I was asked to take on the role as a coordinator to create and help in developing the autism plan for Georgia. We at the Center for Leadership and Disability provide support in education for families and for professionals as it relates to intellectual and developmental disabilities.
So can you give me a sense of the need and why was it seen as this to be such an important thing to focus resources on?
Sure. Okay, so nationally, the number for autism is 1 in 84. I'm sure many of you have heard about the new number that came out, which is 1 in 55 for school-age children. Well, in Georgia, that number is 1 in 84. And the number of children being diagnosed with autism is increasing every day. And it's not something that's going away. It's something that we have to address. And at Georgia State, we are very aware of the need of, you know, helping to support families. And because of that, we decided that that was a mission. The Maternal Child Health Bureau issued planning grants through their state planning grants to help states to identify plans and understand what it will take to improve systems of care in Georgia for children. And it's not just for Georgia. It was actually issued. We've had four states that have received planning grants, and there are a total of 22 state grants, with 19 of them being implementation grants.
Now, the issue of autism has so many layers, and it's not a problem that can be addressed with a simple solution. Can you give us a sense of the different stages that people need resources for throughout sort of a life cycle of a case?
Wow, that takes you to our autism plan for Georgia. Okay, what happened is we sat down and looked at these stages of how a family, what a family goes through. So first there's diagnosis and screening, so actually identification. Then diagnosis and screening. Then you have early intervention. From there you have medical and dental services. You have family support, early education, elementary and secondary education, community supports and services, and then transition, which is a huge one. And then from there, adult services. So it's a full cycle, and the plan is actually based on all of these. We have 10 headings and or 10 domains, and all of them are supported by a foundation of improving workforce awareness, informational resources, finances, and policy.
So for an early childhood case, can you give me an example of what a parent would be able to access or the process of identifying what resources are available? And actually, JJ, if you want to chime in as well in terms of resources, that'd be great.
That's probably one of the challenges in Georgia is the lack of resources and access to it. I mean, we have a lot of things happening, but many families don't know what those are. So one of the challenges we face is when a child or a young adult receives a diagnosis, not knowing where to go. We have Autism Speaks and we have Autism Society of America, which have been leaders in trying to help educate our families. But making that connection has been very difficult. We've gone throughout the state of Georgia and found that many families tell us, especially in rural Georgia, we don't know what to do next after we get this diagnosis. And that's where, like I say, agencies like Autism Speaks comes in.
Yeah, definitely, Donna. That's been one of kind of supporting what they're doing as well. Mm-hmm. Autism Speaks also is supporting, you know, the individual through the lifespan of the diagnosis from, you know, the actual evaluation diagnosis all the way through adult services. So when a family first receives a diagnosis here in Georgia, whether it's either through the Babies Can't Wait, which can assess for developmental delays between the ages of 0 and 3, or if they receive it through the public school system, which can be accessed after a child turns the age of 3, or through a private medical physician as well. Those are kind of the options for diagnostic purposes here. Once they receive that diagnosis, we get a lot of phone calls, like Donna was saying, from families who say, I got a brochure, but my life has changed. You know, where do I go from here? And that's one of the things that we try and do in family services with Autism Speaks. We've designed a 100-day autism toolkit for newly diagnosed families. We provide that free of charge to them. They just need to call our 1-800 number, which I will give to you. If anyone's listening who would want a kit.
Yes, please.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The phone number is 1-888-288-4762. Or you can email us at familieservices@autismspeaks.org. What the 100-day toolkit, it gives families, especially in kind of like you were talking about the rural areas who don't have access to a lot of resources, it gives them a lot of guidance and support through things they can do in-home as well as resources for the school as well. We also provide family support toolkits for the grandparents, for the siblings, for the friends of the family who want to help and don't know how to help this family support the child that has been recently diagnosed. So we always encourage anyone that's got a new diagnosis to please call us for that free toolkit. And then we can also help. We get a lot of phone calls on our 1-800 number also for people who are looking for a speech therapist, who are looking for a support group in their area. So we have our Georgia resource guide that we can share with families. It's kind of a database where we can search by their zip code and try and connect them locally with either another organization, another therapy group or support group to get those services started as soon as possible.
And as parents, it is amazing to me how poorly we reach out to others who have similar experiences. You know, it's just hard to make that extra time. So the types of things that you're talking about are oh so important, because then you're not recreating the wheel every time that you see something. And you also have that opportunity to quit feeling like you've been isolated on an island somewhere and nobody else can understand what you're going through.
Absolutely. I have a 7.5-year-old son, Jackson, who has autism. And when I talk to new moms, I always encourage them, reach out, make that connection, because talking to other parents or families in your area can truly be some of the best resources, you know, around. So I think that's very true. People feel like they're just so alone. And that's one thing that's nice about Autism Speaks. We also have a walk coming up here in Georgia, Sunday, May 19th at Atlantic Station. And I remember my very first walk when my son was diagnosed, it was a feeling of, holy cow, there are so many other families that are affected by autism. And we have a resource fair where people can come and learn about all the different programs that are going on in Georgia and the Marcus Autism Center and a variety of other things. So it's great for new families to come out and connect and feel like they are part of that community.
Excellent. Now, what are some of the common questions that families have when they find out that they've got a child with autism?
I would think that some of the questions, I'm thinking about my own experience first.
Absolutely.
Is, you know, okay, I have this diagnosis. What do I do next? I mean, what is the next step? What therapies or treatments or, you know, what should I educate myself on? How do I deal with the school system? I mean, there are a lot of questions that kind of whirl through your head, but I would say the question that I probably hear the most is, what can I do to help my child, you know, especially if the child has a language delay or is having behavior issues? So, you know, just identifying those resources and what's in my community, you know, because a lot of times if you're having to travel a long distance with the child who's having behavioral issues, it just puts more pressure. I mean, it just makes life even more challenging. So trying to identify, what can I do now?
Absolutely. Now, in terms of early diagnosis, that's something that there's also been a lot of talk and information about. What are some of the early warning signs, and how could a diagnosis maybe be missed? Does that happen?
Jim, I'll let you do that one.
Well, I can do the how do you have a diagnosis that is missed. Catherine was initially diagnosed with ADD, not ADHD, but ADD, and learning disabilities. And, you know, we went through the school system and the psychiatrist that was assigned to us through the school system, and everybody kept telling us it was ADD and learning disabilities. And the thing about autism is, like many, many disabilities or even many illnesses, everybody has their own symptoms. Everybody is a little different. So the old saying, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. It doesn't always mean that everybody's going to react the same. Well, Catherine interacted really, really well with adults and older children. You know, she understood, and part of that was because as parents, we're very direct. You know, we're not, you know, there's no hidden social agenda, if you will. And so we were not seeing the same communication difficulties that were apparently going on in the school and with peers. So when Catherine moved from elementary school to middle school, and the pressures just mounted because she's no longer in a homeroom, no longer has a single teacher looking over her, you know, just everything changes. And of course, they're starting to get into puberty. She just could not handle that. And so we had significant meltdowns, significant behavioral issues that were brand new to us at the time. And we had no clue what was going on. We actually ended up having to take Catherine out to Stanford because that was the only place that we could get into in a reasonable time frame to try to figure out what was going on. And, you know, again, it is so important to get the early intervention because it's like anything else. If you're trying to read when you're 16, it's harder. You know, and so you've missed all of the supports that will allow you to build later, and it's very easy to get missed.
I would say my experience was very different in that my daughter Christy is a twin, and I had her twin sister as my guide. Christy, interestingly enough, she walked, she talked before her twin sister. But we took her to her 18-month appointment checkup, and I said to the pediatrician, we have a problem. She's no longer responding to anything that I say to her. And the pediatrician, because we had gone on a regular basis, met all the checkups, she said, no, Donna, I don't think that's true. And I said, no, she's not. And she called her name, and Christy did not respond. Well, this happens with a lot of children in that the first thought was she's maybe has a hearing problem. Okay, so we went through the whole battery of tests for hearing, but my pediatrician was wonderful in that she connected me with Babies Can't Wait. Therapy started, you know, and we went through the whole thing, and we were fortunate. Christy was actually diagnosed at 22 months, which is, you know, that we would ideally love that for all of our children. But she experienced regression, and that happens for some children. They will meet the milestones, and then things will start to turn around, and you realize something's not happening.
So. That actually happened with my son as well. Mm-hmm. He was diagnosed at age 2 with moderate autism. He is now almost 8 and is still nonverbal and has significant medical issues as well that go along with that. But because of early intervention and the therapies and supports that we've had in place, he has made progress and continues to make progress and communicates via a communication tablet and has made progress, you know, is succeeding in what he's doing, but it's been very challenging. Mm-hmm. You know, autism currently, the earliest it can be diagnosed officially is 18 months. But, you know, that is, there are studies mm-hmm. being done currently. They're looking at even trying to move that needle up yes. to 12 months because they are finding that getting those supports and services as early as possible can be helpful. And, the Easter Seals has a wonderful website screening of, if you Google Easter Seals and mm-hmm. first
signs. It's called
signs,
Make the First Five Count.
Yes, and mm-hmm. It's wonderful. You can start at age 3 months just keeping a track of your child's development. It's not screening for autism, but it's just making sure that your mm-hmm. child is developing on track. And then AutismSpeaks.org, we have an early access to care. It's a four-step. It takes you through if you have questions. We list about the milestones and look for the signs. We have a video glossary. You say, well, my kid does this with his toys. Is that autism or mm-hmm. is that just being a kid? And you can kind of watch. We have this great video glossary of what a child with autism looks like versus a typical child doing the same kind of activity. So you can kind of go, oh, okay. Because mm-hmm. Sometimes as parents you read about it, but sometimes visually seeing it, you know, and like, you know, anyway, so there are several different resources there in that area where you can start at a very young age if you have any concerns, you know, speaking to your pediatrician. But at age 18 months, you can also take the MCHAT, which is a toddler checklist, which is a pre-screener for autism that the American Academy of Pediatrics uses at their well checks
yes.
To now pre-screen children for autism as well. So, you know, ideally, every child is supposed to be screened for autism at their well checks, but we know that doesn't always happen.
Yeah, I would encourage parents to make certain that if you have a concern, do not hesitate to express that concern
Absolutely.
To your pediatrician, because that's what happens. You know, had I not said she is no longer acknowledging my presence, nothing would have happened. And if if you're not comfortable, if this, you know, you're not getting the feedback that you need, then, you know, I encourage you to find somebody who will listen to you. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, they have an awesome campaign, Learn the Signs, Act Early. So you can Google that as well. And they have all the milestones, things that you should look for. Very big program.
So it sounds like it's very important for the parents to take a very active role in observing the development mm-hmm. early on and tracking these things. And once they realize there is something wrong, the education has just begun at that point. There's so much more that you need to find out about. Do people find this overwhelming? All of the services that you all mentioned are wonderful that they're all out there, but I would imagine it can be quite overwhelming.
Yeah. All the parents here are smiling, so yes, you know, the
it's reality
is...
It's a whole new language.
It is a whole new language. The first time I met another mom when my child was 2, and she said, oh, you know, my child has sensory issues and doesn't handle the noise, and then was talking about ABA therapy, and I was like, she speaks my language. You know, I met someone who, because it is, it's a whole new language, a mm-hmm. whole new world, and it.
Maybe that's we should do a campaign, Do You Speak Autism?
Do you speak the language? Yes.
Now, what is Autism Speaks doing in terms of research and finding links in autism?
Absolutely. Autism Speaks is funding many, many grants currently right now for scientific research as well as community grants. As I mentioned, one of the focuses is that we are looking at that Move the Needle initiative to where the earlier diagnosis. They're also looking at studies for genetic and environmental studies. We're still trying to find the cause of autism, and as well as treatments, better treatments for the children and adults that are here now. So there's a wide scope, and if you go to autismspeaks.org/research, you can read about all of the current grants. We also have a family participation link on that site as well, if you're interested in kind of being a part of some of those research studies as well. Families can reach out that way.
Excellent. So in addition to the overwhelm with resources and services, I would imagine financial overwhelm can also be a factor. So David, I want to bring you into the conversation to talk about the financial planning aspect of when you find out that you have a special needs child.
Yeah, well, first I was going to make the comment that I might be the odd man out. I'm the parent of a child with Down syndrome, but what I found interesting in the conversation was that there are some similarities and very much differences. That overwhelming feeling is there, and so I think that's a similar issue. But also, the difference, my daughter was diagnosed probably 20 minutes after she was born. In Down syndrome, you generally know what to expect, but it is overwhelming as a parent. But the initial, that feeling when they're born, you're dealing with kind of those issues right in front of you, and there's always some issue right in front of you. But also it's important to think long term, and that's where, parents and families need assistance in figuring that out. And I think the benefit of, kind of peace of mind and clarity and confidence for the future is really important, because the anxiety of those thoughts can be troublesome. So,
absolutely. And so, right, as you're navigating through the early childhood and the adolescence, and now you're looking at your child becoming an adult, there's, they reach a stage where they become more and more independent, I suppose, throughout their life.
Certainly they want to be independent. I mean, the thing about having a child with a disability that is so important is they're children. They are people. The disability is secondary on
exactly.
This. And, I can speak, from my experience with Catherine. There are times I have to remind myself that she's 19 and a girl before any of this other stuff hits, And so the fact that she likes boys is still troublesome to me, but shouldn't be unexpected considering I went through it with her older sisters,
Exactly.
You always have to do that. Mm-hmm. But I want to step back and go back to the question you put to David, because I think it is so important in our families with early intervention, with all the things that go on, is that we really do as families have to start planning. We can't knee-jerk reaction. We can't do a knee-jerk reaction to everything, because we don't know when we may take a road financially that may foreclose other opportunities later. So it is very important to plan financially and think about what's going to happen in the future. One of the things I see is, and I can wear this hat a little bit, is the whole idea of, what about my retirement? I have to, that whole thing of, I hope to outlive my child by a day syndrome of, I've got to be here forever and ever and ever to help support. Well, that's not necessarily the case. And it's not necessarily healthy for me to be thinking that I'm going to work past normal retirement age. What about my wife? So all of those issues really need to be dealt with at some point. And just like early intervention, early financial planning is very important. And that's just the financial planning for how are you going to get from where you are to where you need to be. Are there other kids who need to go to college? How are you going to support that? Then if you get past that, how are you going to help your child with independent living, or at least as independent as they can get, and all the way down the whole life cycle? So all of that has to be very much on the front burner. And you don't have to be a millionaire. You don't have to have a couple of $100,000 to do the planning. You just need to have a sense of where you're going, what the financial supports are going to be at different stages in life to be able to make your path. You know, paths are going to diverge, but you need to have a general sense of where you're going to get.
Absolutely. So that brings me to how and when do we proceed with the plan, and what are the issues that need to be looked at?
Well, I think the when question, better sooner than later. But at the same time, I see quite a few families that just keep putting it off and putting it off. And I think the reason for that is that it is overwhelming, it's confusing, and you know, you tend to put those things off that are overwhelming and confusing.
Or that bring you in contact with lawyers.
Exactly. So, you know, the present is always a good time. I think to Jim's, to back up Jim's comment, it gives you, you know, the earlier that you begin, the more options that you have. And you can keep those open, you know, much longer than waiting. So.
Now, the basic role of benefits, how does that play into the equation?
Well, there are, you know, the benefits that individuals with developmental disabilities can access are very basic. Talking about SSI, Supplemental Security Income, and, you know, that's just basically food, clothing, shelter type benefit. But there are supplemental needs that that come up. Maybe Jim might have a few comments on that.
Well, there are two. There's SSI, and then there's the medical side of that, which is the Medicaid portion.
I just wanted to jump in and ask a question because, you know, I've just been dealing with a completely different issue, but a medical issue that I never thought about before. And when it hits, when something hits, and I'm sure this is true when you get an early diagnosis or your child's born and you right away know something's wrong, you never thought about it before. You never thought about the financial differences. So my question is, and anybody can take this and answer it, what are you looking at in terms of finances, big picture, compared to a child that doesn't have autism? How much more expensive is it? I know that's a crazy question, but, you know, I just...
Wow.
It's kind of like asking how much does a car cost?
Yeah.
Well,
it's a lot of different...
But well, I think the reason I'm saying that because, you know, I think we all get a sense right away that there are obviously additional services, mm-hmm. additional therapies that are needed, and probably for some people for the rest of their lives, mm-hmm. And some not for the rest of their lives. And so how do you, when you've got a three-year-old or a two-year-old with a diagnosis, how do you even know what to plan for?
You don't necessarily know at age three. I mean, because at that point, you really don't have a sense of how independent that child is going to be when that child becomes a young adult. You also have different therapies that are out there, some of which have clearly been received scientific support. Then you have other therapies that other families swear by that have no scientific support. And, you know, if there's no scientific support, usually you're paying out of pocket for that. I know families that, you know, that will pay $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 that they really can't afford for therapies that they're being told by their friends have helped this other child or maybe some other adult. So, you know, the whole sense of how expensive is it sort of depends on what resources you can access. You know, if you've got two parents working and you've got a child with autism, you know, can you have somebody in the house to allow the mother to continue to work? So, you know, you may have that opportunity. that's just a cost of can you afford it, and are you as a family comfortable with somebody taking that role? You know, maybe it's a half day. It doesn't matter. You know, I mean, minimum wage is, what, 10, I should know this, 10 or 11 bucks an hour. So, you know, you start figuring that out, plus withholding. It doesn't take very much extra time to get very expensive. So it really does depend upon what kind of insurance the family has. Does it cover any of the behavioral kinds of issues that are so important for many of the kids with autism? What about the extra medical? You know, does it cover food subsidies if there's a gluten type of issue? So there's all sorts of costs, and it can be very expensive. I am aware of families who have chosen to send their children to private boarding residential facilities rather than have them in the public school systems because they quit fighting City Hall, so to speak, and self-funded it, and it was in excess of $125,000 a year.
As I mentioned before, my experience was very different than Jim's. You know, when my daughter was diagnosed, I was a working mom. My husband worked, and, you know, life was pretty good. But the level of care that my daughter needed required me to stop working. Not only because she attended school 25 miles away from our home, but because there is a need in Georgia and in many states for after-school care. So if my child gets out at 2:30, there's nobody who's there to take care of her and to help. And we were doing all of the therapies. We were we had her in ABA, which is Applied Behavior Analysis Therapy, which, you know, it just for someone to work with her 40 hours a week was $50 an hour. So, you know, there was no excess for us. In addition to that, I had two other children. And so my reality was very different. So I was home for 14 years because of the need to be at home. We do have plans, but our plans are very different in that, you know, we have life insurance policy. We figured out who, if something happens, who will step in to help. I mean, we've identified those things. But, you know, many families of children on the spectrum, excuse me, they don't have access. And it makes them a little afraid, but that should not scare them into not planning for what happens to your child or young adult in the event something happens to you. You know, you have to think ahead. It's very important. You know, so.
Absolutely. My husband and I actually took separate flights for a while because we were convinced that no one else could take care of Jackson. And so we had to make sure that one of us was, you know, going to be on the ground
at
all
times. It's like the president and the vice president. You can't roll together.
But, you know, supporting what Donna is saying, you know, Georgia is one of now the minority of states that has failed to pass insurance reform. Mm-hmm. And Ava's Law was recently again, you know, on the table and was again sent to committee to be studied for yet another year. Donna mentioned ABA, Applied Behavioral Analysis Therapy. It is been studied. There is research backing. The American Academy of Pediatrics testified at the hearing. This is the most effective behavioral autism therapy treatment option there is. But as you mentioned, she paid $50 an hour. I've paid $50 an hour out of pocket, and no coverage for insurance. And it's very frustrating. You think if your child was diagnosed with, you know, diabetes, the insurance would pay for those treatments and coverage. But if a child is diagnosed with autism here in Georgia, the mm-hmm. most effective treatment, you are told there is treatment for your child, but you cannot access that treatment. Mm-hmm. And it is very frustrating for many of our families. And when you're talking $50 an hour at 15 to 20 to 30 hours a week, I mean, even if you have all the resources in the world, you're still going to mm-hmm. run dry. It is It is very frustrating, as you can tell. I get very upset about it.
And there are other therapies outside of ABA.
Absolutely.
So, you know, my daughter's been in hypotherapy.
Yes.
She's been in sensory integration therapy. What you will find when a child is diagnosed with autism and probably many other disabilities is we will throw everything in to see what works. We'll throw it all up against the wall and see what sticks. Mm-hmm. And because we are very concerned about the future. And how, you know, if there's anything that can change the course.
So. Well, how can people get involved in the community and help make a difference, urging legislators to make insurance reform?
Absolutely. AutismSpeaks.org/advocacy. You can click on Georgia or you can call the Georgia office at 770-451-0570 and get involved in our grassroots campaign. Again, we were all just at the Capitol. We spent the past several months there, and unfortunately, we will be back next spring to bring it back up. So we absolutely need more people to join that effort.
It's an ongoing battle.
Ongoing battle.
And I would say also to go to the Autism Plan for Georgia. This plan is a framework for what can happen and what's possible in Georgia. And the website is www.ga-autismplan.com. Again, that's www.ga-autismplan.com. The plan has... as I mentioned, it covers 10 domains, but the thing that's interesting in it is when we were working on developing the plan, Autism Speaks was at the table, Autism Society, DBHDD, all the Department of Education, everybody's come together to figure out what can we do. So this plan is a way to get families to see what's available. We have a survey that's online right now that we really, really, really need to hear from families, providers, anyone who touches the lives of children with autism. And it's on that website so that we can say this is what we want for our children and our young adults and our adults. So we encourage you to please, please go to the website and read the plan, know what's available, know that the state is working on something, and that we need your input.
Excellent. Jim and David, from the personal and financial and legal aspects of the plan that parents need to look into, aside from taking separate flights everywhere, from a risk management and a planning standpoint, what are some of the areas that people can focus in on and at least alleviate some of that feeling like I've done what I could do to make the best of, you know, the future outcomes?
One of the things that I think is important, and I want to, after I answer your question directly, sort of want to back into is, we need to remember that transitions, not for all children, but for many, many children on the spectrum, transition is very difficult. So, for example, with Catherine, if I tell her we're going to go out to lunch, and then 15 minutes before we're supposed to leave, something happens and we can't go, I have to really focus her on why we can't go and what's going to happen, because she's already got in her mind that this is how the day is going to happen. So shifting is very difficult for her. Well, think of the worst thing that could happen in a child's life, and that is to lose one or both of your primary caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
The loss of a parent is by far the greatest transition that's going to ever occur in their lives. And that has to be planned. That has to be staged in exactly the same way that you're planning for them to go from first grade to second grade, from second mm-hmm. grade to third grade. What has to happen, and how are you going to get them there? And it doesn't take a huge amount of money to make it oh so important to do that planning. I mean, it's very, very important just from a what happens with the person kind of situation. Mm-hmm. But it's even more important financially, because if a child is unable to be wholly independent as an adult and qualifies for SSI, Supplemental Social Security, and is receiving Medicaid as their health care insurance, what you don't want is you don't want the death of a parent to kick the child off government benefits. Mm-hmm. Section 8 housing. There are all so many different types of benefits out there. And, you know, if the child is living in a group home, you know, not qualifying for Medicaid can mean the loss of that living arrangement. So it's really important to understand that if a child has more than $2,000 of resources that are termed under Social Security law countable resources. The only exceptions really are the house and a car and a little bit of death burial insurance. So if they have more than $2,000 in their name, they lose that qualification. And all it takes is mom and dad dying, or dad dying, and or even uncle dying, and having money inadvertently come to that child. So planning has to be number one.
Yeah, it was just a further comment on that. That, you know, at the death of a parent, you know, assets can transfer through your will or operation of contract. So, for example, beneficiary designation on a employment life insurance program or something like that, that you don't think about, can really mess up the works.
All of a sudden, $2,000 and
anything over that, and then you have a big problem on your hands. You lost your benefits, and then you have to go see the lawyer.
Well, that's right. There are things lawyers can do at that point, but the problem is that you have lost your ability to protect those assets for the rest of the family. We may be able to tie it up and get the child back on government benefits, but it's like putting it, you know, it's like sticking your finger in the dike. You haven't done the real planning that you need to be able to do to get the entire family where they want to be.
Well, and that brings us to our results matter moment for today. So I'd like everyone now to kind of talk about the results that, and I think that's a perfect bridge in terms of communication to siblings, to understanding, you know, communication amongst parents themselves and their caretakers, assembling the plan, realizing that the future of this child is going to be different than maybe what you first envisioned, but you want to create a vision for that future and create a plan to enable that. So what are the results, and what is the communication to family members, to the community, that can really make a difference? Actually, JJ, let's start with you.
Okay. As we were kind of talking about earlier, it definitely is important with this planning. And it is an uncomfortable topic, like, you know, was previously mentioned. It's hard to look at those facts that my son is 7 years old and he probably will need support for the rest of his life, which will probably be after my husband and I are gone. Last year we did contact an attorney, and we did get a special needs trust put in place for Jackson so that he will have those benefits set up for him going forward. And after we did get that set up, we did take a flight together, so I feel like we felt a little more comfortable about where we were going. But I think takeaway as far as how what this means for the siblings and the families and the parents, communication is key. Talking about what your hopes and dreams are, though they may have changed, they're still your hopes and dreams for your child, and sharing that vision and that idea and having that team in place is so important and to families. And I just encourage, you know, any family that's listening, if they are feeling like they are alone or have questions and concerns and don't feel like they have any support, please call us at 1-888-288-4762 and let us know, you know, what you're needing and how we can try and help you, that you definitely aren't alone in this.
Absolutely. Well, Autism Speaks becomes part of your family. All mm-hmm. of these resources mm-hmm. in your community extends. That's mm-hmm. excellent. David?
I think the more communication, the better. Whether it's siblings, you know, as they grow older, I mean, they're definitely thinking about what happens when mom and dad aren't around. What role am I going to play? And that really goes into the kind of the details of you as a parent thinking about what's going to unfold, who may or may not play a role in that child's life. So that aspect of the plan is definitely something that should be communicated very clearly. So,
What are the results that you talk about with clients when you're walking through those aspects of the planning?
The results, so I think maybe the intangibles are the mm-hmm. biggest benefits, peace of mind, clarity, confidence, you know, just something to kind of mitigate the anxiety. You know, those are the big benefits, I think.
There's a lot of smart things you can do.
Yeah.
Donna.
Well, you know, I was listening to Jim, and my thought was education. You know, when we receive it, our children receive a diagnosis of autism, the first thing that we do is try to educate ourselves about autism and what does it mean and how does it impact the family. But I think it's important to educate yourself on, you know, what happens? What do you need to do? The many things that Jim, you know, just discussed, I think that education leads to you all, to the family, having something in place that can sustain not only the child, you know, or adult, their life, but sustain the family. And that's real important, that you educate and not just take the planning piece as, well, we don't have the money, we don't have this, but that you do have something that you need to start with, a framework, just like our plan. It's a framework so that families will have something that they can rely on and say, if this happens, this happens. And we have confidence in knowing that we've set out a plan that makes sense.
Jim.
Most businesses have some type of strategic plan. And whether we think about it in those terms, most of us have some kind of thought process about where we would like to be, both in our professional lives and in our financial lives and in our social lives. When you have a child with a disability, it's important that that information not remain just in your head. It needs to be communicated and thought about in terms of, I have a plan, I know what I want to do. And it's the whole idea of, you could have a great plan, but if you haven't communicated it to anybody else, if you get hit by that proverbial truck the next day, how do I know, as your lawyer, what to do? How does David know, as your financial planner, what to do? Did we get a plan that follows what you want to have happen, or are we just sort of coming in behind the fact and trying to fix whatever falls out of place at that point in time? So it really makes, you know, I can't tell you that planning is much more important with a child with a disability. I think it's as important if you don't have a child with a disability. I mean, you do have to plan for where you want to be. You aren't going to get there if you don't have a plan. But it really becomes so much more personally important.
Absolutely. This has been an excellent show. Thank you all for sharing so openly, so emotionally, and so abundantly with all of your knowledge and advice and resources. I want to special thank my guests today, Jim McCartan, David Glass, Donna Johnson, and J.J. Hurley. I hope you all will take advantage of all the advice and resources. We will post the links online. This is Elizabeth Gordon signing off from Results Matter Radio. We'll talk to you next week.
This has been a joint production of Burr and Foreman and Business Radio X. Burr and Foreman is a full-service law firm with offices across the Southeast. If results matter to you and you want them to matter to your law firm, please give Burr and Foreman a call at 404-685-4337. For more information and to find the right attorney for you, visit burr.com. That's B-U-R-R.com.